because entrepreneurs, we treat it as a game, right? And we just want to, you know, win the game and grow as much as we can. And honestly, I enjoy the game. It's fun.
The problem is most CPAs aren't tax advisors. They're just tax preparers. So they take all your information after the year's over, and they pretty much put your report card together, right? There's people that we both know that, let's say they needed $5,000 a month to live. Okay. I got friends that find out how to make $500 an hour, and they're like, great, I only need to work 10 hours a month. Guys like you and me figure out how to make $500 an hour, and we're like, how do we work 100 hours a week?
But it took me 5 years to get started. I got like 33 properties under contract and canceled them. Some of those properties, man, I could have bought for $65,000. They're like $600,000 now. And just like, oh, man, where would I be if I just had a mentor just to make me feel comfortable to get past the fear? So there's an expensive lesson to not have a mentor. Hey everyone, so today I have a very special guest, one of the speakers that's coming to our event. Actually, his name is Ryan Bakey, CPA out of Illinois. Man, thank you for being on.
Oh, it's going to be an amazing event, and thank you for having me today.
Man, are you excited about the event December 6th, 7th?
I am. I haven't. So the last time I spoke on stage was in Nashville earlier this year in front of about 2,000 people.
Wow.
Yeah, I almost shit myself, but I did all right. I've been doing speaking for the last 4 years now, so I always get a little nervous before I go up there. It's kind of like I'm definitely not Patrick Mahomes. Have you heard that story? How it was the AFC Championship against the Bills. They said that this man's heart rate was higher when he was on the sideline than when he was in the actual game, because he was more worried about his team choking than him playing offense. I thought that was crazy, but I'm no Pat Mahomes.
Oh, that's hilarious. And yeah, I'm pretty new, actually. We've been doing events since June, so that's just how fresh I am at this. Prior to that, I'm usually just behind the scenes kind of nerdy guy, you know what I'm saying? So anyway, can you tell us a little bit about yourself then? I mean, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, I grew up always going to small schools, small grade school, small high school, small college. And I knew if I wanted to become a super important business person one day that I had to establish myself. I had to get my CPA. I became the youngest CPA in the state of Illinois, and I still hold the record to this day of not the youngest, but the, you know, soonest to get it, right? I was 21 years old when I got my CPA license, and I worked at a consulting firm called Deloitte, which is the largest accounting firm in the world.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah. Because I thought to myself that in order to get even or level set myself with the people that went to Penn State, Alabama, you know, U of I, all these nice schools, me going to a small Christian school, that I had to get into Deloitte. That was going to be my fast track to the C-suite, right? And
yeah.
It wasn't but 2 years in that I realized that I was helping people who are already rich and wealthy become even more rich and wealthy, right? And I decided that I didn't want to help the everyday person, because to be honest, I don't think every single person's called to build wealth, to be quite frank. There's creators and there's consumers, right? But those people and their family that are going to change their family tree, that's who I wanted to help. And that's when I decided to leave Deloitte, leave the cushy, you know, six-figure corporate job with a fast track to C-level, and start my own accounting firm focused on real estate investors, helping them save tens of thousands of dollars every single year. Fast forward 3 years later, we're about 15 employees, over 500 clients, do, you know, info products, communities, courses, online events, workshops, and I couldn't be more thankful for where I'm at now. And I also invest a lot too. So I have anywhere from single family homes, and I do a lot of campgrounds, RV parks. I recently did a hotel with my 401k, and also part of a skyscraper here in Chicago. So that was pretty cool.
Oh, that's really cool. Well, congratulations, Ben, for being the youngest CPA, and especially with the company. I know that you did say something, and I say something kind of similar. I don't believe that everyone can be an entrepreneur, you know, to be honest with you. And not everyone is the wealth person. Some people just want to get by, but they just want to live and just have fun and not really, you know, be an entrepreneur, you know. But it sounds like you're very strategic for the people that need that are entrepreneurs that need to make sure that they're being strategic with their CPA plan instead of just cookie cutter. I guess that's where I was getting. Just normal W-2 stuff. You're talking about being strategic with it.
And to your point, I say this all the time. There's people that we both know that, let's say they needed $5,000 a month to live. Okay. I got friends that find out how to make $500 an hour and they're like, great, I only need to work 10 hours a month. Guys like you and me figure out how to make $500 an hour and we're like, how do we work 100 hours a week?
That's
just different people, right? Different types of
people. Yeah, because, you know, I'm sure that you're similar then, because entrepreneurs, we treat it as a game, right? And we just want to, you know, win the game and grow as much as we can. And honestly, I enjoy the game. It's fun, you know, so for sure. So you said you did do single family too. How is the, now I know this out of all the stuff, skyscraper, I would definitely want to talk about, but on the RV park, how are you liking the RV park? We almost got one maybe 3-4 years ago. And I just said, man, I don't know enough about it. And it was actually my brother, and the seller was willing to do a seller carry back. And then we were going to get a, you know, financing and first lien position and mixed with a little cash, but we ended up not moving on it. But how are you enjoying the RV parks?
I love the RV park and campground space because it's so different than single family and short-term rentals. I'll give you a little example. So the problem that I ran into with short-term rentals is my upside is intrinsically capped, because at the end of the day, a short-term rental is going to trade off what's called the sales approach, meaning whatever the house down the street's going to sell for, that's what my property's going to sell for. Whereas an RV park is going to trade off a cap rate. So if I can boost the NOI of that business or that park, I can trade at a cap rate and eventually exit for a higher amount. So that was one of the reasons why I pivoted from short-term rentals only and into the RV park and campground space. I mean, another reason too is the stability. I think it's a lot more safer. If I got, you know, I have a $1 million house in Miami, you know, normally rents out from normally $700 to $900 a night. I've gotten $1,500 a night before. But if it doesn't rent out, I get zero, nothing.
That's right.
In fact, I lose money because I got to keep the lights on, right? So if I get no renter, then that's zero. But I might have an RV park space with 50 units. There might be only 25 or 30 units rented out that night because it's a week, you know, it's not a weekend or it's an off day, right? Or off season. But I'm still making money. I'm still recovering some of my costs. And so that's another reason why I like that asset class a lot better. Is you're spreading out your risk compared to a single family home that's not occupied or a short-term rental that's not, has a guest. But the most important thing is the financing. It's, you have these mom and pop business owners who they've ran that RV park their entire life. All their net worth is tied up inside of their primary home and that park. And you go to them, and every single park I've acquired, I've done 3 deals, all have been seller financing, and I've used the same exact script for each one. I go, hey, look, you built this from the ground up, with your bare hands, no handouts, right? Well, that means you have a $0 cost basis, because I'm a CPA, I understand that, and I can teach it to people. So you're gonna go and sell that RV park. The one we bought, first one I got was for $2.5 million, little something and some change. So, hey, look, you don't wanna sell this because you're gonna have to pay capital gains tax on $2.5 million. By
the
time
right.
Uncle Sam gets his cut, like you're gonna be left with 1.8, 1.9, right? Immediately, 30% gone, capital gains gone. And on top of that, the two biggest killers of wealth are taxes and inflation, by the way. Taxes and inflation.
That's
so,
right.
Bam, they lose 30%. And now that money that they have, that 1.8, is losing value because of inflation. It's sitting there in a bank account. Next year, it's worth 1.7. Next year, it's worth 1.6, 1.5. And these people are too old enough to invest in the stock market. They don't have enough time for the stock market to go up 10%, down 5%, up 17%. They need stability. So their best option is to sell or finance you their property, their investment, because number one, they save a lot of money on taxes because they're able to spread that capital gain bill out over time. And number two, they're able to keep up with inflation because now their money is being invested. It's earning a fixed rate. And at the end of the day, if you default, they come and take back the property. And I've used that pitch every single time.
Yeah, real quickly, you actually answered what mainly people ask me. They say, Shane, why would someone sell you a property, like an apartment complex or an RV park? Why would they sell your property and just keep it? And why would they, you know, why would they not just cash out? And for example, one of the apartment complexes I had, the owners that had it 37 years.
Right.
So like they had a zero cost. I mean, they'd already depreciated out completely. And I asked the seller, I said, what are you going to do with the money? Which was about $2.5 million. And they said, we're going to pay the capital gain tax plus the depreciation recapture. which I think is around 33% or something. And then they're going to take the principal and put it in something making 4 or 5%. I think it was 6% actually. And the type of fund they were putting it in, they didn't get paid for 2 years. Yeah. So I said, wait a minute, you're going to sell it for 2.5, pay the capital gain and the recapture.
Gone.
Put the money away and not make no money for 2 years and make 6% interest only. Why don't you sell to us creatively? So one thing that you're saying that I think is really neat and for everyone at home is you're giving them an alternative, and actually it's actually beneficial to the seller, and you know the education to be able to help educate them to see that there's a better way. Am I right?
Yeah, and like I said, it comes down to those things, taxes and inflation, and just understanding the person and being able to explain that to them, because nobody taught them this in school. It's not their fault. Nobody taught them this, but you have to be able to educate them, because like I said, there's really three reasons. It's they do it from a tax perspective to keep up with inflation, and seller financing it to you is probably their best investment decision too, because they don't have time for the stock market to do what it's going to do. It's too risky. Yeah.
So how, well, what percentage of your portfolio is all creative financing?
Definitely more than half. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And I wanted to mention, you know, it's not, I definitely want to buy it at creative, but I don't lead with that as my only option.
Yeah, you don't limit yourself to just creative.
Typically, when we write an LOI, it's normally two or three offers. And it's normally a conversation that goes like this. Hey, look, what you're asking for it, kind of a lot of money. But I'll give you that money if you agree to my different types of terms, right? Hey, you know what? I think you should get more for that property. In fact, I'm going to give you an extra $300,000 above what you're asking for. But here's the catch. You got to finance it to me at a 4% interest rate over 10 years, right?
So no, that's right.
Price or terms, you got to pick one. That's one of my early mentors told me that. He goes, whenever you negotiate a deal, you tell a seller he can get his price or he can get his terms. He can't get both.
No, 100%. So let me ask you a question. What do you believe the importance of a mentor is?
Oh my God, man. I always say, like, if I could stroke a check for what I've lost and not knowing how to do something, I would do it 10 times over. I'll give you an example. So 2022 was the second year that my CPA firm was in business. We had booked overall we did about 700 or 800 calls with prospective clients, which is a lot. And I was taking calls. I had other CPAs taking sales calls, which was a huge mistake, by the way. You got to have salespeople take sales calls, not CPAs take sales calls. So
100%.
Learn that lesson. But I calculated that we didn't close 400 people in 2022. They didn't pay a dime, nothing. Really? If I would have just been able to close 25% of them, that would have been an extra 100 clients. And at the time, our average client was paying somewhere between $5,000 to $7,000 a year. So it cost me $500,000 not to know how to sell. So I took that lesson and I learned. I spent all 2023 learning how to sell. Give me an objection. Give me it. I'm handling it and I'm spinning it back to the prospect. And those calls that we lost because we didn't know how to handle objections, we're now getting them because, quite frankly, I don't even let them spit the objection out of their mouth. I'm pre-handling it in my sales script now. So that's just a lesson. I probably spent 30, 40, 50 grand learning how to sell, but worth every penny.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. So you said something really pretty neat. So yeah, you try and answer what your potential objections are because you've heard the same objections over and over again while you're talking to them. You'll mention the objections. So have you already talked to your wife about this, for example, or you're the decision maker?
Perfect.
Or have you thought this through? Okay, great. And then you start going into, okay. Where did you learn most yourselves from? Or did you just learn after many mentors?
Yeah. So a good salesperson knows how to handle objections. A Jedi salesperson purposely plants objections in the prospect's mind just to smash them later. That's what a Jedi does, right? Where did I learn? Everybody, man. I learned from, Alex Hormozi's Purple Book, right? $100 million offers. You got Dan Henry, awesome dude. I learned a lot from Dan, spent a lot of time with Dan. I learned from Ty Lopez, of course. I've learned from Perry Belcher, Jason Fladlin, some of the OG internet marketers, Dan Kennedy. I've just learned how to sell and market to people really well.
So Amazing. So yeah, mentors are 100% the way to go. A lot of people are a little scared. Honestly, my story, I was 25. I knew I wanted to get into real estate, but it took me 5 years to get started. I got like 33 properties under contract and canceled them. And I actually went by with one of my friends and we drove by and looked at some of those properties that I canceled, I didn't get. And I said, man, where would I be if I just had a mentor just to make me feel comfortable, to get past the fear and to make me do it? I'd say, man, I'd be like, some of those properties, man, I could have bought for $65,000. They're like $600,000 now. And just like, ugh. So this is an expensive lesson to not have a mentor.
Yeah, it's the fear of, a lot of people are not thinking about the opportunity cost of not making a decision. Because if somebody wants to invest in even our CPA service, for example, right? So, and we're not cheap either. And most of our people are paying between $7,000 to $10,000 a year. But you have to think of what's the opportunity cost. Because you just told me that you're a real estate agent making $500,000 a year, right? Okay, great. Well, you're going to pay, would you agree that you're probably going to pay $130,000 to $150,000 in taxes every single year? Okay, so over the next 10 years, you're set to pay $1.5 million in taxes. $1.5 million. And so expensive compared to what? Because I'm going to help you save on that tax bill. I can't, you know, I'm not going to wipe my hands and make it disappear and send you to jail because it's illegal. But I'm going to help you save the most amount of money as possible. It's like, is that worth a $7,000 investment, right?
Yeah, 100%.
So expensive compared to what? Right.
Yeah, people don't think of the long-term benefits sometimes. A good CPA would save you way more than what you're paying them.
Yeah.
You know, so 100%. Now, you did say something earlier. I just want to go back. You said the difference between a single-family home and an RV park. Single-family is residential. RV park is based upon cap rate, which the value comes from. So just correct me if I'm wrong. So single-family, it kind of goes up and down based upon the economy, what the comps are going. But the RV park is based upon the numbers. Can you elaborate on that so the people at home understand that?
Yeah, standalone single family home is normally going to trade based on sales approach, whatever the one down the street sells for. Unless you have 50 of them and you can bundle them up and sell them as a package. That's the only way that you would ever get them to trade at a cap rate is if you bundle a lot of them up. We've had a couple clients do that before. Now, the RV park, it's a business. Most businesses are traded off of NOI, whatever the net operating income of the business, compared to whatever the industry cap rate is for that asset class. And so you're able to get, it makes everything a lot easier. It makes paying off investors a lot easier because in order to pay an investor out a single family home, you're not going to do it from the cash flow from it. No way. The only way you're going to do it is a refi event or a sell event. But that RV park, I don't have to wait to a sell to pay off my investor. I'm going to refi. And like, there's been some deals where the cash flow from it is enough to be able to at least give them their return quicker. It may not pay off their initial investment right away the first couple of years, but it makes borrowing money in the RV park space a lot easier than borrowing money for, say, single family homes. And one last thing I'll add is it's not that one is better than the other per se. It's just, you want to do everything. Like, because here's one thing I learned is people never want to downgrade their lifestyle. People will never downgrade their lifestyle. So you got a family that's living in a 4-bedroom house. The last thing they absolutely want to do is sell that one and go buy a 2-bedroom house. And the people living in the 2-bedroom house, the last thing they ever want to do is sell it and go live in an apartment. And the person that lives in an apartment, the last thing he wants to do is move out of that apartment and go stay in an RV park, right?
That's right.
So people never... In times of recession, right, or economy downturns, people never want to downgrade their lifestyle. That'll be the last thing they change. So I want to have all of it. I want to have the short-term rentals and RV parks for the upswing when people have, because look, people need somewhere to live. People want to spend money and splurge on vacation. That's why I have a little bit of everything.
Yeah. So do you do fix and flips or do you do just buy and holds or what does your portfolio kind of consist of?
Mostly buy and hold. And that's another important lesson. I'm a buy and hold guy. That's what I was taught. That's how I learned. You know, you read the Burr book or the Brandon Turner stuff, and it's like, buy, never sell. You know, you have mentors say, one of my mentors, he goes, real estate's for buying, not for selling.
You know, that's right.
I think the good investor knows when to hold on and when to sell. And it's a pretty easy calculation to make. It's something that we help our clients do. I call it a cash on equity audit. So you look at the net value or the net equity of your property. Let's say I got a long-term rental but I got 300 grand of equity in it. Okay. It's netting me 10 grand a year in cash flow. So if I do 300 grand divided by 10, that's 30 years. 30 years, I'd have to rent the property out just to make back the equity that I have in it today. Well, 100 divided by 30, I'm earning a 3% return per year on that property. I could do better in a T-bond with no risk, right?
That's right.
So yeah. When you look at a portfolio, you got, let's say you got 10, 20, 30 properties. We're constantly looking at what's our equity position compared to how much we're making. And we need to sell some of those underperformers off so we could take that equity and go buy better performing properties.
Absolutely. Let me ask you a question. So when you sell, do you 1031 those?
So that's another question too is, the problem is most investors, they only know 1031. That's all they hear. So they just, oh, I'm going to just 1031 forever. The problem with that is, especially for people who are younger, that 1031 is kind of like a ticking time bomb if you think about it. And
yeah.
It's also kind of
your
like,
basis becomes nothing. Yeah.
Well, and I don't want to say it's like crack or coke or something like that, but it's like the more you do it, you have to keep doing it because you start off with a 200K property. Next thing you know, you got $1 million property. And here's the mistake that people make. People think that the tax bill that they pay is based off the equity that they get at closing. It's not. It's based on the original purchase price compared to the sell price. So I've seen people buy that $200,000 bungalow, think trade up. Now it's worth a mil. They did a 80% LTV. They took out 800 grand on it. They go to sell it. They only get 200 grand at closing table. But guess how much the tax bill is? The whole thing. So I've seen people pay more in taxes than they get in equity when they sell. So you got to be really careful about falling into that, I'm going to 1031 everything. I like to have 30 to 40% of my portfolio that's not encumbered by anything. No 1031s, no cost seg, no gimmicks, right? Because if I need to access that money in that part of that portfolio, I can, no strings attached, right? I just hope I don't sell on a downswing. I hope I don't catch a downswing. If I got part of my portfolio that's 1031 or cost seg, I'm going to be paying the piper when I want to go access that money, right? I got to pay taxes. I got to, if it's DSCR loans, I might have to pay prepayment penalties. And I hope to God I'm not accessing it on a downswing. Right?
100%. Well, real quick too, because I know me and you are just running off. Can you explain what a 1031 is just for those that don't know?
Yeah. 1031, the easiest way is, if you ever remember playing Monopoly. See, I love Monopoly because there's a lot of lessons that you can learn from that game. When it comes to real estate.
I love Monopoly. Yeah.
If you just pass go and collect $200 and never buy anything, you lose. That's the same thing in life. If you just sit there, wake up every day, you know, go to a 9-to-5, aren't investing in yourself, just pass and go collecting 200, you're going to lose, right? It's the people that buy some properties, buy some businesses that win the game of Monopoly. Anyway,
build the house, the motel.
Build the house. But what do? They got the four greenhouses and they trade up for the big red hotel. And that's what a 1031 exchange is. You got a property that's gone up in value, your equity's gone up in value, and you're going to trade it for another property. And the catch is, as long as you do that, you're going to sell a property and then buy something, you can defer the tax bill. It's not free, but you're deferring it to a later period of time. Why? Because time value of money says, if I got to pay taxes, I'd rather pay them down the road than right now, right? I hope that's
okay. No, that's great. Let me ask you a question. Would you say that? Here's a theoretical thing. Let's just say someone has a cost basis of $150,000, but their property is trying to sell it for $1 million. Okay. And let's just say they want to sell. Would you say that would be a good way for you to come in with seller financing to buy?
100%.
Can you explain why that would be really good for a seller?
So I used to think that seller financing only benefited the buyer, right? It's like, hey, we could buy these properties, no tax returns, no credit score, no bank statements, no nothing, no verification. But until I learned of like, man, the seller can really benefit from it because of those reasons that I mentioned before, strictly from a tax issue, if they sell that property and they just walk away, it's like I said, bam, 25, 30% of that net equity gone. They may not want a 1031 because 1031 means they have to buy another property. What if they want to exit? They don't want to deal with real estate anymore, right? They're done. Well, their only other option is to sell the property and just bite the bullet and pay Uncle Sam. And great, now you don't have to buy another rental property, but you just lost all that money to taxes. And what are you going to do with it? Because it's that $900K that you got, it's going to lose value to inflation. So you're better off. You're better off in that example. What I would do if it were me is I would want cash at closing, whatever the cash that I need that year or couple
bare,
years.
Bare minimum.
Yeah. Maybe I take 200, right? 250. And then I'm going to finance the rest of it over a 7 year, 10 year note with interest.
And on the 250 in principle, if they have $150,000 cost basis and they take 250, what amount of that would be what they have to pay in taxes?
So it's
more or less.
Whatever you do is you take the overall gain. So let's say it's a $850,000 gain, right? Or should we just say a $0 gain because they, or a $1 million gain because they depreciated down to zero, right?
Yeah, let's do that. Yeah.
Yeah. So if it's $1 million gain and the seller is getting 250, they're getting 1/4 of the overall proceeds. So they're paying 1/4 of the tax in that year.
Absolutely.
The rest of it's stretched out over the life of the loan, 5 years, 10 years. And the power of that is, look, you're locked into paying $200,000 in taxes if you sell $1 million property. It's when you pay the taxes is important because, like I said, bam, you pay that in year one, money's gone. Money's not earning you anything. You stretch that $200K out over 10 years, well, you're only paying $20,000 a year for 10 years.
Okay. Here's another question. And I'm just going to ask nerdy questions because I'm here learning too. You know, let's just say they've depreciated down to zero. They've had it 30, 40 years. I don't know. And let's just say they want to sell it for $1 million, but they decide to do no money down because they're old people, older guy. And they say, I don't want to pay nothing in taxes. I don't even want to take $200,000. Or I don't even want 100. I just want this for my retirement. If they sell their finance with zero down, when do they pay the depreciation recapture?
So the depreciation recapture is also spread out over the life of the loan too.
Okay. Yeah. Some people say it's due in the first year. That's why I'm asking you.
There's a caveat. So accelerated depreciation, like if you do a cost segregation study, that depreciation is recaptured in the first year, no matter what. It's the straight line regular depreciation that's recaptured over the life of the loan. So important to think about, because if you cost like a property and then you sell or finance it, you better be getting enough money at closing to pay the depreciation recapture, because it's all due that first year. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I have a lot of people ask me, they're like, don't you have to pay the depreciation recapture? I said, well, no, not necessarily. It just depends on the situation. That's right. Can you explain what cost segregation is to everyone at home? We're nerding out. Everyone don't understand some of these things. And you're just like, boo, 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 like, because you're so smart, man, but dumb it down for us. So can you explain what cost segregation is?
Yeah. One of the benefits of buying real estate as opposed to say, putting the money in the stock market is you hear about the tax benefits, right? Tax benefits. But what does it really mean? One of the big ones is depreciation. It's the fact that you can have cash at your bank account, but you don't have to pay taxes on it. So an easy example, I have a long-term rental where I think I netted 12 grand a month or 12 grand a year on it. I had $10,000 of depreciation on the property. And so at the end of the day, even though 12 grand hit my bank account, I only pay taxes on two because I had 10 grand worth of depreciation, right? Now, cost segregation, if you think about it, because when you buy a property, every property that you buy has a certain amount of tax savings. It's like a piggy bank. You know, I had this Winnie the Pooh piggy bank. My dad and mom gave it to me, and they said I could have it when I was 18, but I never opened it up. I need to go bust it out of that thing and get it open. But every rental property you buy, you have a piggy bank of tax savings. And if you don't do anything about it, you're just taking a little bit from that piggy bank every single year. Or if you want, through the power of a cost segregation study, you can smash open that Winnie the Pooh thing in the first year, take most of the tax benefits in the first year, and then trickle the tax benefits out over the life of the property. It's either 27 and a half years for residential or 39 years for commercial and short-term rentals. And going back to that time value of money, for those of us that are in high tax rates, high active incomes, time value of money says we want to take those tax benefits now. We don't want to wait till later, right? And that's what cost segregation is in a nutshell, is speeding up the rate at which you take the depreciation on your property.
And if you don't use it up in the first year, can it roll over to the next year?
That's
you
right.
can use it as needed.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Do you actively do any cost segregation on yours? I know you mentioned sometime, just on a little bit of percentage.
Yeah. The way that it normally shakes out is because I do a lot of syndication deals and I do a lot of, you know, I can't buy a skyscraper by myself, right? So I do a lot of deals with other people. And a lot of times those deals are doing cost seg studies on the properties. So I'm getting a lot of depreciation from these syndications that I'm a GP in or these partnerships. And so I sometimes don't need to do cost segregation on the properties that I own 100% because I have enough coming from the other properties.
Other syndication.
Yeah.
Here's another question, okay? If someone puts money into a syndication, I'm sorry if I'm telling you nerdy stuff, man, but I'm not a CPA, of course, but I've watched videos and I've, you know, tried to put some of it into practice. But let's just say someone does a syndication. Let's say I do a syndication and I'm known as a real estate professional. So I get like pretty optimal taxes by what they say, right? If I have like 10 random people that are not real estate professionals, but they come into the syndication and I do cost segregation, do they get a benefit on that or just on the regular depreciation that's spread over the long period of the property?
So everybody and their grandmother can benefit from cost segregation, okay? The people that benefit the most are the people that are actively involved in the property or they're a real estate professional, right? So if you and I buy a property together, but I'm not involved at all, I'm not a real estate professional, I can only use my share of the depreciation to offset other rental income, okay? I can't use my share of the depreciation to offset my active income, my business income, or my W-2. You can. If you're a real estate professional, your share can go against your active income. But if I'm passive and I'm not involved, then I can't use it against my W-2 or business income.
Absolutely. Okay, great. And that's awesome. And you know, it's not often that people get to have a street. Now, I'm going to be honest with you. This is what we always say. When I think CPA, and I know this isn't true for everyone, but when I think CPA, I think of just some old guy that just has a cookie cutter little thing. How often do you really find a good strategic CPA or hear of them? Is it pretty rare or is it usually just very cookie cutter?
Yeah, the problem is most CPAs aren't tax advisors, they're just tax preparers. So they take all your information after the year's over and they pretty much put your report card together, right? That's what they do. They just prepare what's already there. A tax advisor is somebody that's going to work with you throughout the year to make sure that you're doing the right things that you need to do, whether you should buy a property, sell a property, refi, do this, do that, almost like a tutor, like a math tutor. I failed senior year math in high school. I should have had a tutor. I didn't.
Yeah.
But the tutor is a CPA that's a tax advisor, right? If you got a CPA that's not advising you, they're just a tax preparer. That's your report card. You need a tutor. You need somebody that's going to help you pass the class before you get the F on your report card and then you got to take it home to your mom. She beats the hell out of you because you got an F.
Yeah. And that's the difference I see in you, man. It's just very hard to find someone like you. So we're hoping that, of course, we have you speaking at our event December 6th and 7th. We wanted a very strategic person, or like you said, a tutor that can help guide these people, especially if they're getting into real estate. They don't understand the power of being a real estate investor. So you may make money actively in whatever job you have, but we believe in preserving in real estate, in our opinion. You know, of course, there's other facets, but that's kind of how we've always been explaining it. And it's hard to find someone like you, so we're glad you're coming.
I appreciate you saying that because the only guy that I know that has a private jet, he goes, you make your money in business, you keep it in real estate. And that's all that I needed to hear, right? So I know exactly what I need to do. I need to make as much money as possible doing an active business. And then I need to keep it and preserve my wealth, grow my wealth by using real estate.
Exactly. And that's how you pass it to your family. Do you have, I have a very selfish question. So this is the thing I'm in. So I was taught to keep things in land trust or multiple LLCs and stuff. What happens? Okay. Let's just say you have 50 homes. Okay. And you know, you could sell them individually, of course, and sell them for more. But you want to package them up, possibly you have to sell at a discount, but you want to 1031 it. How do you do that? let's just say you had 50 properties and 50 different LLCs or 50 different trusts. How would you 1031 that?
You'd have to wrap them all up in under one entity before you did it. So it would take you a year or two of getting prepared for something like that and getting them all bundled up under one common control before you're able to do that. Because the problem with the 1031 is the title. Whoever sells it also has to be the one that buys the new property. So, you know, 123 Main Street LLC that owns your Arkansas property also has to buy 546 Jackson Street in whatever state you're buying the new property.
Like and all yeah. that stuff, yeah.
Versus if you okay. wanted to just be like, hey, I want to roll all 50 of these up into one big deal, you'd have to get all 50 of them under one LLC and then go buy the big apartments.
And so here's my personal situation. I have about we just hit 400 single family, okay? I have some in land trust. I have some in one LLC, another LLC. We have them just all over the place. What would be your advice to me to be able to put them all under one entity? Now, just to clarify though, one of my LLCs that I do have properties in is the beneficiary of all the land trusts. Is that okay? Or like what would be your advice to me on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's more of a like an asset protection or attorney question of like how many LLCs do you want to have? And in some states, it don't take much to have an LLC. It's some states are like, hey, were you in business last year? All right, great. Pay this $50, $75 fee and sign right here, right? Now, some states, they require you to file additional returns for LLCs. If you're in Tennessee, Texas, California, New York, you know, they require like other state returns. So the costs can get kind of heavy. Now, what I teach people to do is you kind of want to have a dollar figure in your head of equity. Of like, hey, here's what I'm like willing to lose if I had to. And that's that once your property gets more than that, it needs to be in its own LLC, right? So let's say my dollar amount's 100. When I first started, my dollar amount was like $100,000. I would buy properties in my personal name. And as soon as it got to more than $100,000 in equity, I'd put it in an LLC. Because that was my
threshold.
Is there
a cost to do that? Or is it the same because it goes straight to your personal tax return if it's just a holding LLC?
From a tax filing perspective, it's still filed on your personal return, so there's not an extra fee. Now, you got to be careful transferring property from your personal name to an LLC because you could trigger local transfer taxes, potentially the due on sale clause, although I've never really seen that get enforced, to be honest. But definitely local transfer taxes. I mean, in Cook County, Illinois, we got them. Pennsylvania's brutal. I know Tennessee has them, Florida has them, Michigan has them. They got these transfer taxes where if you know, so that's where I teach a lot of people sometimes, hey, if you're, because there's, most of the time, your personal conventional loan rate and an investment loan rate are going to be like 1%. So there's a big difference. But sometimes you find where the commercial rate is the same or if not a little bit higher than the personal rate. And that's where you're better off just closing in the LLC. So then you don't have to worry about all this having to transfer it over later on. You just close in the LLC because you're going to put it in the LLC anyway, eventually.
Okay. All right. So now let's talk about nerdy stuff I've seen on TikTok. Okay. Because you hear all these different people explaining neat depreciation ideas. Like you hear people about buying yachts and depreciating it or jets and stuff. Can you explain kind of the, like, is that true? Number one. And number two, like, how does that kind of work? And how would buying a plane or a yacht actually help you on your taxes?
You know, one of the things my dad always told me, he goes, you can pretty much get away with anything as long as you got a good story, right? So you could royally come home late, you could mess up, but if you got a damn good story, a reason why you were late or whatever, you'll be like, oh, okay, that's fine, right? It's just like if you're late to work or late to school, you go grab donuts and then you show up late, everybody's like, they don't care because you brought donuts, right?
You brought donuts.
I like that. Your reason why when you, because the thing is if you go into something with the intention of like, I'm only doing this to save money on taxes, you're going to be very like disappointed, in my opinion, because you have to have some kind of revenue generating activity in order to deduct something. So like you could buy a jet, you can buy a yacht, but it also has to be tied into, hey, it's income generating. Because when you're not using your jet, you're leasing it out to other people to use the jet. Now it's a deductible expense. You know, if you just buy something and you don't use it for business purpose, right, you're going to get audited and you're going to lose. So you need that story. You need to be able to tell that story of, hey, this is a profitable business activity. I got this jet in a separate LLC, separate business name. I had, 13 charters last month or however much I had. And you want to prove to the IRS that you're a quality business person, and you're not just doing that to commit tax fraud, right?
Yeah, that's right. What about someone who buys like a plane for their personal business stuff? Like I don't know, I don't do this, but let's just say I owned a construction company, and we're doing five different, projects around Georgia, maybe because I live in Georgia. So let's say we're doing one in Florida, one in Tennessee, one in South Carolina, and we're using it just for business purposes. Is that count too? Does that count as helping with revenue?
You would have to prove that. And it kind of goes back to this thing called ordinary and necessary, right? So is it ordinary for me to get on a plane and go to Atlanta for your event? Of course, 100%. I just hop on a Southwest flight. Is it necessary for me to charter a private jet to your conference?
Probably not. But
probably not.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
Let's use real estate agents as an example. If I'm selling houses in what town are you from?
No, we're from Atlanta.
You're from Atlanta, right? You can be a realtor and you can have one of the old Mercedes C-classes, right? If I'm a realtor in Los Angeles, Beverly Hills, I got a Maserati because that's ordinary and necessary for that clientele.
Mm-hmm.
Agreed?
Yeah.
If I'm a doctor, is it ordinary for me to drive to my practice and back? Yeah. Do I need a $250,000 Porsche GT, whatever the new one is? Probably not.
Yeah.
You just have to have a good, like I said, you have to have a good story and you want to
make your case.
Yeah, your case. Yeah, right.
Okay. And what do you think about, since this is kind of new as well, what do you think about, what is it, the government getting 87,000 IRS agents and stuff? Have you seen more audits coming or happening 100%. Since they've said that?
Yeah, 100%. Unfortunately, they're cracking down on your 400,000 plus earners, really, is what we've been seeing. I mean, we've had a couple of clients in the $600,000 to $700,000 wage earning get audited. And it's just because there's no doubt, people cheat a lot on their taxes, right? No questions asked.
Mm-hmm.
And they the way that the audits are working right now, every single dollar that the government's spending and giving the IRS, $6 are coming out of the slot machine. So it's a very profitable thing for them right now. So it's just a message to a lot of people to just be prepared. If you're taking your taxes, your information to like a fly-by-night sort of accountant. They weren't working with you throughout the year on strategy and you're trying to do all this stuff at the 11th hour, like probably going to lose an audit because you don't have good records. Versus when we plan and we strategize with clients, like we already have the tax plan put together before the year's even over. So when we go to file their tax return, it's more of just a formality. And if they ever do get audited, we have all their documents and records to be able to defend whatever position was taken, if they bought a property or they bought a boat or whatever they did, like we have documents to prove that.
Yeah, that's why people need someone kind of like you that kind of strategizes it. And usually during an audit, when people say, I wish I would have paid that extra $2,000 or $3,000 a year to spend time with Ryan, that's what I would assume anyway.
It's just like a lawyer. Yeah. Most people don't call a lawyer until they're already in jail. Right.
Yeah, or some people say, I don't like attorneys until you need one. Then you love them,
Yeah, you don't want to keep a lawyer on retainer, but you friggin' damn well wish you did when something happens, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So you're going to be coming to our event December 6th and 7th. You don't have to tell everything, but like, what are some of the things that you're definitely wanting to show and give value to the people at the event?
Yeah, one of the things that I really want to talk about is a lot of mindset shift. A lot of people don't understand that you have two minds going on. You have a conscious mind, you have a subconscious. And the minute that you can start seeing that the things around you are the way they are for a certain reason, and you can overcome that, and really you can understand that the whole world's out to get you. Everybody, like, it's a dog eat dog world out there. And you gotta definitely fight for yourself and your family and learn these strategies in order to build wealth, whether it's multifamily, single family. Learn how to use tax strategies. Learn tax strategy from a seller financing perspective So you can go and convince that guy that you want to buy his $2 million apartment building from him, because that's what's going to move the needle. Is you know what really moves the needle? A good story. Because you can always argue facts, you can never argue a story, right? So when you talk to this guy, you can give him facts. He's going to need numbers at the end of the day, but it's really easier to convince him with a damn good story. Hey, I helped so-and-so over here, you know, save a bunch of money on taxes and keep up with inflation, blah, blah, blah. Like, you have a really compelling story, you can get the deal done 90% of the time.
So you see the importance of a good investor is always learning, for example, right? So when these people come to the event and they hear kind of the strategies for taxes, the mindset, and then, of course, we have some other great speakers like Ben Mala. We have a guy named Sharif. Hearing all these things to add to their tool belt, then they're able to achieve more, basically.
That's exactly what it is. It's a tool belt, and you got to have all the tools at your disposal, and more importantly, you got to know which one to use and when. Like, and I can have the hammer, but it ain't going to be no good when I got a screw and a nail, right? Or I could have the screwdriver and it ain't going no good when I got to pull something out of the wall. So, like, knowing what tools to use at the right time is super important, and who to rely on, who do you go to get that question answered or that problem solved is even more important.
Absolutely. So also another thing I was going to ask you is, where do you see yourself in the next 3 to 5 years? Like, where do you want to be? What do you want to be known for? Where do you want to go?
Yeah. So I always tell people, you know, my only goal with money is anybody with my last name doesn't have to worry about it. All right. That's my only goal with money. Cause look, when you pass away, it's not like they take a tomb. They don't take a screenshot of your bank account and put it on your tombstone, right? You're remembered by the way that you make people feel. Cause all this stuff, the freaking guy, you know, rest in peace to the Liam Payne guy, One Direction, hundreds of millions of followers. Nobody's talking about him now. It happened 2 weeks ago.
That's crazy.
The majority of the population is not going to remember who you are. Queen Elizabeth died, I don't know how many years ago. She ruled England for 75 years, and we're not talking about her anymore. So the only people that are going to remember you are the ones that you changed their feelings. You changed the way that you made them feel. And how I want to help people is I want to build those communities. I see myself traveling in, you know, California, Florida, New York, Tennessee, here in Chicago, and putting on seminars, putting on workshops, educating people on the tax strategies they can use, how they can build wealth, how they can negotiate seller financing. I really see myself building these communities of people everywhere I go. So that way I can show up in a random city and I'll have 20 or 30 people that will attend a meetup that I do. So
absolutely. And one good thing about you is you're not just an accountant, CPA, right?
Yeah.
You're a real estate investor. So you understand everything that they're going through. And also you probably understand some things they don't even know. Like, I believe you answered questions for some of these clients that they didn't even know they needed to ask. Am I right?
And that's exactly what we discover in the process. A lot of people come in thinking it's a tax question when really it's a lending issue. It's a legal issue. It's an estate planning issue. So people don't know what they don't. I mean, that's another important lesson. Like, it's one thing to know that you don't know something, but what's more dangerous is not knowing what you don't know.
100%.
Not knowing what you don't know is way more dangerous than being like, yeah, I know that thing exists and I know it's a problem, but I'm not going to do anything about it. Not knowing that the problem is there is costing you way more money and way more headache than, you know, knowing it's there and then solving it, right? The people that make the most amount of money in this world aren't the people who can solve problems. It's the people that can identify a problem before it even exists. And they cut it off at the neck, right there.
So whenever your clients are with you and they're done, they're like, golly, I didn't know. Like, they feel enlightened and probably have a lot of faith in you at that point. Like, man, this kid knows what he's doing.
I'm always one step ahead. You ever see, and that's how you have to solve problems for people, because if the mentor is up here and the student's down there, there's a disconnect in learning. I'm speaking a different language to you. That's why the first step of Alcoholics Anonymous is you got to find a mentor. You got to find somebody that's already gone through the program. Not that I've been in AA, I just know the first step of Alcoholics Anonymous. But have you ever seen Catch Me If You Can by Leonardo DiCaprio? It's one of my favorite movies. You know, Tom Hanks in the movie, he goes, man, you fake being a lawyer, a pilot, a nurse, a doctor. He goes, how did you fake being a teacher at BYU for an entire semester? And then in the movie, he goes, I didn't need to know the whole semester. I just had to be one chapter ahead of the students.
So oh, that's amazing.
He'd read the book the night before and then teach it the next day. And that's where, as educators, as coaches, mentors, that's how we have to be with our students and our clients. Because if I'm up here and they're down there, that there's going to be a disconnect. I just have to be one chapter ahead of the person that I'm trying to help. Because people who were once fat, they help people who are fat now. If you were broke, you can help broke people. You are the most qualified to help the person that you used to be.
Yeah. So funny enough, I learned Spanish. You know, my wife, I was going to say fiance. I just got married like last weekend, you know, but
yeah, congrats.
When I was learning Spanish, you know, it took me years and I had to learn from the ground up. But I realized this, I can teach someone how to speak Spanish quicker than she can because she grew up in it, because I had to learn it as I go. And I don't speak like perfect, but, and she speaks better than me, but I can teach it better. So it's very similar to what you're saying.
Yeah, man. It's awesome. Yeah.
Well, man, hey, look, I look forward to having you over here. We're excited. December 6th and 7th. Can you tell everyone at home where they can find you?
Yeah, you can find me on all social media at Learn Like a CPA. So to learn like you're in school, Learn Like a CPA. I also have the largest community on Facebook for real estate investors learning how to save money on taxes. It's called Tax Strategies for Real Estate Investors. Got over 11,500 investors in that community. And those are the two best places to find me. I'll always respond to your message.
Yeah, definitely. Awesome. Well, man, I appreciate you hopping on. I look forward to seeing you in person here. How many days are you staying? Are you going to come stay both days? You can only stay a day.
Both days is the plan.
Okay. Yeah. Awesome, man. And yeah, I'm excited to introduce you to all the other speakers too. So it'll be real fun. I appreciate being on, and you guys, we'll see you guys later.